All right. So, topic for tonight is the message of Sefer Dvarim and how we understand what exactly Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to do in communicating to the people in the 40th year in the desert. What is especially distinctive about Sefer Dvarim is its very discreet, clear structure, which sets it apart from any other book in Chumash. If you look in any other book in Chumash, there isn't such a discernible structure. Take Sefer Bamidbar, Bereishit. There is no other book that has such a clear structure like Sefer Dvarim. Sefer Dvarim basically can be broken down into three parts. We have the first 11 prakim, which are basically a combination of historical prologue at the beginning, and then Moshe's exhortation, his rebuke to the people, guiding them in terms of what they should be doing once they enter the land. That's basically the first section. Second section, from Perek Yud Bet through Kafav, so 12 through 26 is all of the halachot in Sefer Dvarim, and that's why it's known as Mishnah Torah. And so we'll take up the question in a little bit, why exactly do we have a book in which we're repeating all of these halachot? In many cases, new halachot, but why do we actually have any halachot in this book? That's section number two. Section number three, which is from the beginning of this week's Parsha until the end of the Sefer, the third section, is a section that is centered upon curses. This week's reading of the catalog of curses in Kitavo. And then, as we'll see, the sections that follow in Sefer Dvarim really build upon that third section about the curses. So that's the first observation about Sefer Dvarim, the very discrete structure. Now, in order to understand what exactly Sefer Dvarim is about and why exactly it has such a discrete structure and what the relationships between these three parts is, we need to make one more observation. And this is an obvious observation when it comes to Sefer Dvarim. And that is that the overwhelming majority of Moshe Rabbeinu's concerns in this book are guiding the people in terms of their future religious worship. Namely, making sure that the people do not abandon God and that they do not become Ovdei Avodah Zarah. That is the overwhelming concern that Moshe Rabbeinu stresses, basically from Perek Aleph up until the very end. So the question is why? So what is Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah is not a religious phenomenon in the ancient Near East. If you would have gone to any other culture in the ancient Near East and said, are you allowed to worship other gods? The answer would have been yes. Each nation might have their patron god. So Moab might have their god Chemosh, but they're also going to recognize other deities and they're free to worship other deities. That's not going to be true, of course, for Bnei Israel. So where does the idea of Avodah Zarah come from and how would it have been intelligible to Bnei Israel in a polytheistic environment? Avodah Zarah is not in its origins a religious phenomenon. Avodah Zarah in its origins is a political phenomenon. And this is going to be the point of departure for this year. What do I mean that it's a political phenomenon? The idea that one people owes its undying allegiance and loyalty to, is subordinate to some suzerain, some sovereign, some higher being, is something that we find in the ancient Near East in the form of what are called vassal treaties. Vassal treaties are a form, is a genre that we find attested throughout the ancient Near East. And if you take a look at the source sheet on page number one, how we can actually have. Take a look at source number one. What we're going to be looking at are vassal treaties in that green area, which is known as the land of Hatti. So that is the area in which the Hittite dynasty would have been located. And we're also going to be looking at vassal treaties that come from Mesopotamia. So the blue area in the north being Ashur, the orange area in the south being Babylonia. These vassal treaties come in two different types. There are the Hittite treaties, and we're going to be looking at examples of this. There are the Hittite treaties in which we would speak of a bilateral, it's almost like a bilateral contract. Each of the sides in this treaty, you have the overlord, the sovereign, and his subordinate, the vassal. Each of them owes certain duties to the other. So the duties that each owes basically goes like this. The vassal, self-subordinated to the suzerain, to the sovereign, to the overlord, and in return for this subordinate subordinating himself to his higher king, this higher king pledges to come to the protection and to ensure the safety of the vassal. That's what we have in terms of bilateral agreements, bilateral treaties among the Hittite treaties. There's also a set of treaties, which we'll see, are not Hittite, but are Neo-Assyrian. The Neo-Assyrian treaties are different. These are not bilateral. It's not that each side owes certain duties to the other. The Neo-Assyrian treaties are exclusively moving in one direction. So the vassal in the Neo-Assyrian treaties owes certain duties to the sovereign. The sovereign owes nothing to the vassal. Okay, these are separated chronologically. So it's not only geographically that they're different, but the Neo-Assyrian treaties, which are coming from Mesopotamia, for the most part, we have in the first millennium BCE. And the Neo-Hittite treaties we have from the second millennium BCE. So we're talking about a difference in both time and space, but basically it's part of one tradition, one set of vassal treaties. This is going to become important for us because if we want to understand what we mean by Avodah Zarah, then we need to compare what we have in terms of Sefer Dvarim and its focus on Avodah Zarah with what we have in these other vassal treaties. And what we're going to see in comparing them is that the structure of Sefer Dvarim matches very closely the structure of these vassal treaties, which shouldn't surprise us given this conceptual link between Avodah Zarah, the primary concern in Sefer Dvarim, and the political form of these vassal treaties. Okay, so let's start by taking a look at the first section, what we have in Sefer Dvarim, namely the historical prologue. So we know at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, Moshe Rabbeinu begins by recounting the story of the Meraglim, and especially Matan Torah and the events leading up to Har Sinai. We have such historical prologues, especially in what I said before are the Hittite treaties. Again, the Hittite treaties are anywhere from the 14th, 13th, 12th centuries BCE, so right around the time of Matan Torah. And the historical prologue in these treaties basically goes like this. The sovereign says, these are the circumstances in which we came into this covenant together, in which we entered into this treaty together. And therefore, because I was gracious to you, because I bestowed upon you certain kindnesses, therefore you subordinated yourself to me. And going forward, I also will owe certain duties to you. And these treaties will typically open with some sort of historical rendition of how this relationship came to be. So take a look at page one. So this is a treaty between Shati Zawa of Mitanni and Supi Luluma of Hatti. So Supi Luluma of Hatti is the founder of the Hittite dynasty. He founds the Hittite dynasty in the first half of the 14th century, sorry, second half of the 14th century BCE, so 1340s, 1330s, 1320s. And he forms a treaty with a small empire to the south known as Mitanni. The context of this treaty is this person named Shati Waza of Mitanni was part of a palace coup. His father was king of this Mitanni kingdom. And with the palace coup, his father was killed and Shati Waza was forced to flee. Shati Waza flees to Supi Luluma of Hatti. Supi Luluma of Hatti takes him in, agrees to go back to Mitanni and retake his what is rightfully his kingdom, and in return enters into this bilateral treaty with him. The great king, so just take a look at the bolded section in source one, the great king took me by the hand and rejoiced over me. The great king and hero spoke as follows. So the great king here being the king of Hatti, Supi Luluma of Hatti. If I conquer Shutarna, Shutarna was the person who staged this coup. If I conquer Shutarna and the troops of the land of Mitanni, I will not reject you, but will adopt you as my son. I will stand by you and place you on the throne of your father. And the gods know my majesty Supi Luluma never goes back on the words which issue from his mouth. So he's saying, I bestowed upon you this kindness. I took you in your hour of need. I'll bring you back and restore to you your kingdom, but in return, you're going to owe me certain duties going forward. So we're entering into this mutually beneficial agreement. Basically, that's what we have in the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, right? The beginning of that first section, historical prologue, Hashem, Moshe recounts the events that led up to this historic relationship between him and Bnei Yisrael. Okay. The nature of the relationship between the two sides, between the vassal and between the sovereign, is often formulated in this treaty tradition in terms of love. So take a look at page 2. Again, where does the language of loving God come from? So the language of loving God really is drawn from this treaty tradition. And we can see this in multiple treaties. So what you have on the left here, what I have is the vassal treaty of Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon is the king of the Assyrian dynasty in the 7th century BCE. So we know Sanherib, who is Chizkiyahu's arch enemy in the end of the 8th century BCE, right? That's the story of Chizkiyahu's tunnels. Sanherib's successor is named Esarhaddon. And in the year 672 BCE, Esarhaddon, who is the king of Assyria, again in Mesopotamia, forces all of his vassals to enter into some sort of treaty in which they will pledge their allegiance to his son, to Esarhaddon's son, Ashurbanipal. And Esarhaddon instructs his vassals as follows in his treaty. Okay, so take a look at the text here. You shall love Ashurbanipal, the great crown prince designate, son of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, your lord, like yourselves. Again, it's loving the vassal has to love the sovereign like the vassal would love himself. By making, and how is this going to be instituted? By making you take an oath, you shall speak to your sons and grandsons, your seed and your seed seed, which shall be born in the future, and give them orders as follows. Guard this treaty. Do not sin against your treaty and annihilate yourselves. Do not turn your land over to destruction and your people to deportation. Do not place any other king or any other lord over you. So now if we look at what we have on the right side, this is Kriyat Shema and the Parsha that follows, V'hayaki V'yacha. Again, we're still in the first section in Sefer Dvarim. You have language that is very very reminiscent of the vassal treaty tradition. V'yavtat Hashem Elohecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol me'odecha. Just as you will love Ashurbanipal, just as you would yourself. V'shinan tam levanecha. You're supposed to transmit this to your children, just as the vassal treaty, the vassal was expected to impose this oath upon his offspring. And then what does Hashem say later in the Parsha? Et Hashem Elohecha tirav yoto tavod, lo telchun acharei Elohim achirim me'elohei ha'amim asher sivvotechem. Meaning, within the political domain, Esarhaddon is saying, you owe your political allegiance to my son Ashurbanipal. So what is Hashem saying? Within the religious domain, you, B'nai Israel, owe me your allegiance. It's simply an appropriation of a political form into the religious sphere. And then Hashem continues, Ki Elkanah Hashem Elohecha b'kirbecha pen yechara af Hashem Elohecha b'cha b'hishmidcha me'al p'nei adama. Hashem is a jealous Lord. What does it mean that he's jealous? Again, that there is this understanding that there is going to be a certain loyalty due to the sovereign from the vassal, in this case the vassal being B'nai Israel. But because in the case of the Torah, we have a bilateral covenant, so that is like the Hittite treaty, it's a treaty that works both ways. Each of the parties owes certain duties to the other. It's not just B'nai Israel that loves God, it's also God that loves B'nai Israel. So turn the page to page 3. So if you see Pasuk Chet, this is Dvarim Perek Zayin, Pasuk Chet, Ki me ahavat Hashem etchem. So Hashem loves B'nai Israel. And why does he love B'nai Israel? U'mishamroat ha-shvua she'nishpa la'avotechem. There's that historical prologue language. Namely, there is a reason why Hashem loves you. Then he will maintain his oath, le'ohavav, to those who love him, umishalem lisonav el panav lahavido. So the language of love and hate works in both directions in Sefer Dvarim, just as it would in one of those forms of the vassal treaty in which each of the sides owes certain duties to the other. Just notice the other interesting thing about that same passage in Dvarim is the language of an amsgula. What is an amsgula? So take a look at the bottom text here. The opening salutation of this letter from Sapilulumus II. This is actually the last king of the Hittite Empire. So now we're in the early 12th century BCE. And And now, so Supilulumus, who is, again, at this point, is still the sovereign, says to his vassal, "Now you belong to the sun, your lord. You are his servant, his treasure. You are his sgula. Now, how is it that you do not acknowledge the sun, your lord? How is it that you are not Yodea, your lord?" Again, notice the language in the parsha that we just read. You have, first of all, language of Yodea, V'yadata ki Hashem Elohecha hu HaElohim. Language of Yediyah in these texts is language of treaties. So why do you not know your sovereign means why are you not engaged with him? And the language of skula is the way in which the sovereign talks about his love for the vassal. And so when Hashem calls Bnei Israel his am skula, what he's basically saying is, I am the sovereign, you are my vassal, and I love you as a good sovereign would love his vassal. Okay, so that's the mutual statements of mutual affection. The middle section, we're going to skip what I have here, is section 4. The middle section of both the vassal treaty tradition as well as Sefer Dvarim, the body of it, are the list of duties that each owes to the other. So in the vassal treaty tradition, the vassal will, for example, under certain circumstances, have to make sure that the sovereign safety is attended to. He'll have to make sure that under certain circumstances, palace coups aren't performed. He'll have to make sure there are certain sexual indiscretions that are covered in some of these vassal treaty traditions. And the core of Sefer Dvarim, that Mishnah Torah, the Halachot, is basically, again, an appropriation of what is this middle section of the treaty tradition, namely the statements of loyalties that each owes, that the vassal owes to the sovereign. Okay, which brings us to the third section, and what is, for our immediate purposes, the end of Sefer Dvarim, beginning with this week's Parsha. Historical prologue, statements of mutual affection, a delineation of the duties that each owes to the other. But there's another element in the vassal treaties that also shows up in Sefer Dvarim, and that is a catalog of curses, first of all, oaths, and an invocation of other deities who will testify to the imposition of that oath. So what does that remind us of? So we're going to take a look in a second. The curses catalog corresponds to what we're going to read about in this week's Parsha in the Tochacha. What you have in the case of Nitzavim basically is both sides formally entering into the covenant, entering into this treaty, and then what happens at the end of Parsha Nitzavim, Ha'idoti Bachem Hayom et Hashemayim v'et Haaretz. Hashem invokes Shamayim and Aretz as the witnesses to the treaty that both he and Bnei Israel have just entered into. Yeah. Okay, so then the question is going to be why has the Torah appropriated this political form within this religious context? So that's going to be.
So isn't different?
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, essentially that's going to be the point, that it's a way of communicating this radical message to people for whom this would be unfamiliar. Yes, that's where we're going.
Just a side question.
Yeah. So it will apply for conquered nations. Typically, that will be more within the Neo-Assyrian tradition, where it's unilateral, where the sovereign doesn't owe anything to the vassal because this wasn't a function of kindnesses that he bestowed upon the vassal. So the vassal is subordinate by virtue of conquest. The Neo-Hittite treaties are not going to be typically a function of conquest. It's circumstance that brought these two parties together, right? So that's going to be the difference. Yeah. Okay, so let's actually start with the curses in the treaty tradition. So turn to page 8. What I have here is section 6. So we'll read examples of curses both from the Neo-Hittite tradition, so that is the bilateral form of treaties, and then the Neo-Assyrian form of treaties, again, that unilateral form. Okay, so starting with the top here again, this is we started with this Hittite treaty. This is the one from the 14th century. "They shall stand and listen and be witnesses to these words of the treaty. If you, Prince Shatiwaza, and you Hurrians do not observe the words of this treaty, The gods, lords of the oath, shall destroy you and you Hurrians, together with your land, your wives, and your possessions. They will draw you out like malt from its husk. As one does not get a plant from the midst of, so you, together with any other wife whom you might take in place of my daughter, and you Hurrians, together with your wives, your sons, and your land, shall thus have no progeny. And these gods, who are lords of the oath, shall allot you poverty and destitution. And you, Shatiwaza, they shall overthrow your throne. And you, Shatiwaza, these oath gods shall snap you off like a reed together with your land. Your name and your progeny by another wife whom you might take shall be eradicated from the earth. And you, Shatiwaza, together with your land, because of not delivering goodness and recovery among the Hurrians, you shall be eradicated. The ground shall be ice so that you will slip. The ground of your land shall be a marsh. Right, it goes on from there. Okay, let's read. Just as another example, let's take a look at the vassal treaty of Esarhaddon just below. May all the great gods of heaven and earth who inhabit the universe and are mentioned by name in this tablet strike you, look at you in anger, and curse you grimly with a painful curse. Above, may they take possession of your life. Below, in the netherworld, may they make your ghost thirst for water. May shade and daylight always chase you away, and may you not find refuge in a hidden corner. May food and water abandon you. May want and famine, hunger and plague never be removed from you. Before your very eyes, may dogs and swine drag the breasts of your young women and the penises of your young men to and fro, very graphic, in the squares of Ashur. May the earth not receive your corpses, but may your burial place be in the belly of a dog or a pig. Right, so we have some of that very graphic language, of course, in the Tochacha as well. You get a sense of the types of curses that we find in both these treaties as well as in the Torah. What's the notion of a tochacha? It's being drawn from this kind of vassal treaty tradition being appropriated into the religious domain. Okay, what follows the list of curses and blessings, or what's associated with it, it's not mechanical. Sometimes it can come before, sometimes it can come after. But basically, associated with these curses and blessings is the invocation of other deities who are going to witness to the oath that both sides are taking in entering into this agreement. So take a look back on page 6 for a moment. So same treaty, Supi Luluma says to, sorry, this is a different treaty, same of the same Supi Luluma. Supi Luluma says to his vassal, I have now placed these words under oath for you, and we have now summoned 1,000 gods to assembly in this matter. And then the whole next paragraph is a list of 1,000 gods who are being called as witnesses to this oath. And if you do not tell me about him, and this is now what they're supposed to witness, if you do not tell me about him but even hide him or go over to him, abandoning my majesty, if you act thus, these oath deities will not leave you alone, nor on your account will they leave alone that man to whom you go over. But if you protect only my majesty and take a stand only behind my majesty, then these oath gods shall benevolently protect you, and you shall thrive in the hand of my majesty. So in this text, there's both bracha and klala. There is a set of curses that are going to be associated with these 1,000 gods, and those curses are going to take effect if you end up violating this treaty. But if you end up observing the terms of the treaty, so then these 1,000 gods will bestow upon you blessing. Again, just as in the Torah, because just as in the Torah, what we have is a bilateral agreement between two unequal parties. Okay, that's what we find, the invocation of other people who will witness the entering into of this agreement is what we have, as I said, in the end of Nitzavim. So take a look at the bottom of page 7. The context here is identical to what we just read about. What are the people doing when they come, Atem Nitzavim Hayom, Le'ovracha Bivrit Hashem Elohecha Uva'alato? What's the Allah that's being referred to? What are the sanctions that are being referred to? The sanctions go back to this week's Parsha, to the Tochacha, meaning what is it that's happening? The people are entering into this agreement, this treaty, this covenant, where by doing so, the curses from this week's Parsha are now being imposed upon them. And at the end of the Parsha, God is going to invoke heaven and earth as witnesses to this treaty, so that if the people end up violating the terms of the treaty, the curses that we're going to read about in this week's Parsha will end up taking effect. Ha'idoti b'chem hayom et ha'shamayim ve'et ha'aretz. So obviously we're not invoking 1,000 gods, but we are invoking shamayim va'aretz, and that's ha'azinu ha'shamayim va'adabera v'tishma ha'aretz imrefi. And if you go back to the beginning of Tevarim, there too we have the invocation of heaven and earth as witnesses to the people. What are they witnessing to? They are witnessing to the fact that you have two possibilities. That language of love recurs here because it's, again, it's treaty language that we saw from earlier that is being brought in here again because the context of this entering into of the covenant is basically identical to the entering into of a treaty type of relationship. Okay, final piece of these vassal treaties is the deposition of the treaty in some safe place in the temple and the periodic reading of that treaty. So take a look at what I have here at the bottom of page 8. Bottom of page 8 where it says deposition of treaty. This is the same treaty from the 14th century. A duplicate of this tablet is deposited before the sun goddess of Arana, since the sun goddess of Arana governs kingship and queenship. And in the land of Mitanni, a duplicate is deposited before the storm god. Again, why are they depositing? Because the idea is these are the gods who are serving as witnesses to the oath, and so they have to be within approximate distance of these treaties. This is a way just of depositing it and making sure that it's always there. So you deposit it in both places, namely, you deposit it in both the territory of the sovereign and in the territory of the vassal. So the both of them have constant reminders. It shall be read repeatedly forever and ever before the king of the land of Mitanni and before the Harians. Whoever before the storm god alters this tablet or sets it in a secret location, if he breaks it, if he changes the words of the text of the tablet in regard to this treaty, we have summoned the gods of secrets and the gods who are guarantors of the oath. So first of all, what is that last line about somebody breaking it? What is that reminiscent of? Moshe breaking the luchot. So what is that sheds light on what Moshe is doing when he breaks the luchot? What does this imply about what Moshe is doing? He's, right, exactly. So the luchot, again, represent the treaty between Bnei Israel and Hashem. So what Moshe is doing by breaking the luchot is he's basically saying this treaty is no longer in effect. So it's not simply that he's angry and does this impulsively, but this is a symbolic act by Moshe that effectively ends the treaty that had just been forged between Bnei Israel and Hashem. In any case, so the other thing that we get out of this text is that the terms of the treaty, or the treaty itself, is supposed to be deposited in the domains of both parties. And that's what we have in Dvarim Perek Lamed Aleph. So take a look at page 9 toward the bottom. Vayitzav Moshe et halvi'im, nosei aron brit Hashem lemor, lakoach et sefer ha-Torah hazeh, visamtem otzo mitzad aron brit Hashem Eloheichem, v'hayasham b'chal le'ed. Again, the language of witnesses. What is happening here? So the treaty, the Sefer Torah, which represents the relationship between Hashem, the sovereign, Bnei Israel, the vassal, is now being deposited. It's not going to be deposited in two separate places because in this religious context, there's only one meeting point. And so the Sefer Torah is going to be deposited in this one place where it's going to serve as an aid. Again, the language about witnessing to the oath that binds the two parties. And again, in the two psukim later, Hakilu Eli Kozikne Shivtechem Vishotrechem, Va'adabravi Oznehem Etadvarim Ha'ila, Via'idabam Etashemai Vetzaret. After instructing the people that they have to deposit the Sefer Torah in the Aron, Moshe again says, now everybody gather, I'm going to invoke Shemaim and Aretz, who are going to testify, who are going to witness the terms of the oath that binds both parties. The other thing that is true about Devarim Lamed Aleph, which we just read about in that other text, is the periodic reading of the treaty itself, right? In the treaty, it's supposed to be read repeatedly forever and ever before the king of Mitanni and before the Hurrians. And what do you have in Devarim Lamed Aleph? Vayitzav Moshe Otam Lemor. Miketz Sheva Shanim B'moed Shnat Hashmita B'chag HaSukot. Bivo chol Yisrael leiraot et pnei Hashem Elohecha b'makom asheivchar tikra tatorah hazot neged kol Yisrael be'oznehem. So you're supposed to read this periodically before the people. So hakel ataam ha'anashim ve'hanashim ve'hatafik ercha sher bisharecha l'ma'an yishmu'u l'ma'an yilmedu v'yaru et Hashem Elohechem v'shamru la'asot et kol divrei ha'torah hazot uvnehem asher lo yadu yishmu'u v'lamdu lirat Hashem Elohechem, etc. So you read it periodically. And what is Aliyah L'Regel in this context? What does Aliyah L'Regel constitute?
So
right, and Aliyah L'Regel is also the periodic meeting of the two parties. That's what, remember, we in the text that we read where one, the sovereign says to the vassal, you are my segula, why have you not visited me recently? So again, the notion is the sovereign expected periodic visits from his vassal as statements of affection. So Aliyah L'Regel and the reading of the Sefer Torah upon Aliyah L'Regel is basically consistent with the way in which these two parties were meant to interact. Now, there's one really important difference between the parties to the vassal treaties and the parties to the covenant between Hashem and Bnei Israel. What's the fundamental difference between them, besides the fact that one is within the political domain and one is within the religious domain? In terms of the parties themselves, what's the fundamental difference between them? Okay, true, right? So there's something different about when you have a divine being the sovereign. What about the other party to this treaty?
That's between the Bnei Yisrael, and here it's between an individual.
Right. Okay, good. Right. Good. Right. So in the vassal treaty tradition, it's not between the sovereign and all of these people. It's between the sovereign and the vassal king. So what then are the people supposed to understand about themselves? Now we're headed in the direction of understanding why the Torah has appropriated this vassal treaty tradition. How are Bnei Israel supposed to view themselves? What are they? Remember, according to Sefer Shemot, what does Sefer Shemot call the people? They are a mamlechet kohanim. So they're supposed to understand themselves as kings, as a mamlechet kohanim, but all of them essentially constitute this one king who has this unique relationship with the sovereign. Each member of Bnei Israel is supposed to understand himself as bound in this unique and special relationship with the sovereign. So that's one really important difference. So basically, what's happening when the Torah appropriates the treaty tradition, basically reformulates these vassal treaties in terms of a covenant between Hashem and Bnei Israel, what it's doing is it's trying to communicate a very difficult idea to Bnei Israel. Namely, what is monotheism? In a polytheistic context, the notion that you owe your allegiance to one God and you're not allowed to recognize the validity of and you're not allowed to worship any other gods, that would have been incomprehensible. So what do they do? What does the Torah do? The Torah comes up with an analogy. What is an analogy in terms of language? Analogies are meant to make clear, to communicate something that is unclear about the original category. So when do I need to come up with an analogy? When what I want to say the first time around is not going to somehow be especially clear. And so I hope to clarify that by drawing attention to something that is similar, where that thing that is analogous will hopefully be clearer to you. And so I think that that's what's happening here. Hashem recognizes that for a population at that time, the notion of monotheism is going to be incomprehensible and is going to be beyond their mind frame, beyond their mindset, not something that they're going to be able to grasp their head around. And so what does Hashem do? By appropriating the political treaty, what he does is he gives them a certain frame of reference. The frame of reference, our relationship is the same relationship as binds a sovereign to his vassal, and therefore in the same way that each of those parties owes certain loyalties to the other, each of them is bound in this affectionate relationship in which each of them owes certain duties, but ultimately is there for the protection and well-being of the other. That defines my relationship with you, B'nai Israel. And if you want to understand what is problematic about Avodah Zarah, which is the underlying thesis of Sefer Dvarim, basically, is you are going to be Ovdei Avodah Zarah, make sure that you're not. If that's the basic proposition, the only way in which the Torah is able to communicate that proposition very clearly is by explaining to the people what Avodah Zarah is and why it is that Avodah Zarah is so anathema. Okay? Avodah Zarah is so anathema because there is this unique relationship that is supposed to bind the people together, just as a vassal and sovereign share this exclusive relationship, and anyone who infringes upon that exclusive relationship is going to be doomed. So David, just going back to what you said before about Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the idea is basically that the Torah speaks Kilshon B'nai Adam, and so putting ourselves in that historical context of monotheism and of covenant, the religious notion that a deity is going to be bound in this unique relationship with the people, Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nai Adam, means that it has to come up with some way of communicating within people's worldview what exactly is new and different and radical about the Torah. Thank you very much.